Welcome everybody, not only to another episode of the Damage Report, but a Friday episode. The happiest, cheeriest time on the show. Brett, am I wrong?
Everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Partying, partying.
No, that's Katy Perry.
Fun, 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 no.
No, that wasn't in the Black Mirror episode I saw, so I don't know it.
Rebecca Black, and also I don't see color.
Oh, it is, it is. Oh, Jesus. Okay, we've gone off the rails. But anyway, we're gonna try to get back onto the rails, and it's a rail that goes to politics town, because we've got a lot of news to talk about. Not only do we have one of the most high profile, one of the most visible members of the Trump administration finally moseying on down that dusty trail. We're gonna say goodbye to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but we have a lot more than just that. We've got Iran. Are we about to start a war with them? Should we start a war with them? Ooh, provocative. And Joe Biden, video from 2006 that will make you appreciate him not in 2006. And we got a lot of that stuff, good chart, bad chart, tons of stuff to get to. Was there anything else you wanted to say?
No, I'm out.
Okay, good. Okay, so then we're gonna just jump into the news then and avoid lawsuits. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, we hardly knew you, but the little that we did know we didn't like. And that's because you're awful and you just lied all the time. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be moving on. This was announced, as all important news is, on Twitter, with Trump saying, after 3.5 years, our wonderful Sarah Huckabee Sanders will be leaving the White House at the end of the month and going home to the great state, capitalized, of Arkansas.
Also, you haven't been president for 3.5 years.
Yes, yes, but I think he means that she'd been working on the campaign.
Well, stop dangling your modifiers all over my face.
And don't talk about his dangling modifier. She's a very special person with extraordinary talents. If you're listening to the podcast, this is from the tweet, I'm not saying that. Who has done an incredible job. I hope she decides to run for governor of Arkansas. She would be fantastic. Sarah, thank you for a job. Done. He says well done. He means it. And she said stuff, but it's not worth reading to you. It was best moment of her life, great opportunity, get to lie on a national stage, it's amazing, whatever. She was very emotional about it. I'm assuming the emotions weren't regret or shame, which means that the emotions were wasted. But she will no longer be the public face of the Trump administration for its, they do daily briefings, right?
Yeah. No, no.
This is a responsibility where you go before the press every day?
Yeah, that's why I stopped doing the segment, is because they stopped having press conferences.
Briefing. Oh, it turns out that the last one was 95 days ago.
Ah, who's gonna not host them now?
I don't know, it could
without
be
her, who's gonna
could
not
Sean
host?
Sean Hannity not host them?
I mean,
could not host them.
That's kind of the larger analysis I wanted to get into, John, is he does have press briefings. He goes on and he has his surrogates. It's just they're not standing before the press in the press room. Yeah. They're parts of the larger media apparatus of Fox, and it isn't just a 30-minute conversation. You know, it isn't a few announcements and then answering questions and asking questions. It's 3 hours on
stream
Fox
of consciousness
between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m.
Yeah. Oh, well, I should say a stream of something approaching consciousness, just him babbling things and never having any hard questions, obviously. That's why he only talks to Sean Hannity and Ingram and things like that. I mean, look, he finally had an interview with someone not like that, George Stephanopoulos, and he got into a huge amount of trouble that will only be worse, I'm sure, when the full interview is finally released. We're gonna talk about all the press stuff, but let's focus now on Sarah Huckabee Sanders and what her legacy will be. And it is important, I think, for two reasons to clarify who she was now. The first is because it's fun to attack her because she's awful. But the second is because the countdown has already started for when a variety of different people will attempt to whitewash what she was as the face of the administration. And before CNN decides to give her a job, you know, commenting, that could certainly happen. Or before they try to clean it up, before she runs for governor of Arkansas, which we'll talk about, like there will be this attempt to pretend that, you know, it was just a really hard job and there was a lot of pressure and having to cover for Trump was really difficult, but she really stuck it out. She was a professional.
Why would you need to do
that? She stood up to the cannons.
You don't need to do that. No one's gonna need to do that.
You mean in that position?
No one's gonna have to do that. What are you changing? The perception that she was the mouthpiece of the president is either that she did an effective job of standing in front of the media and telling them they're stupid, in the bag Democrats, or they're like, yeah, she lied and I'm proud of it. But what do you need to do in Arkansas to shift center? No.
I guess in that case, it's probably less significant. Well, I would make the case if I was running against her that she spent a year and a half being the public face and lying to cover up for her family's being destroyed. sexual harassment and sexual assault charges, families being broken apart, like all those different things.
But my contention is that she would just, in that situation, keep saying what she'd been saying, which is, you're wrong about how you're characterizing those problems.
I don't doubt that, but I'm saying if CNN decides to give her a job commenting, they're not gonna say, we're gonna bring her on because she was an effective liar for the administration. They're gonna pretend that she was a strong, tough defender of the president. That is the sort of whitewashing that I mean. Pretending that she did anything other than cover for Donald Trump attacking the press, encouraging violence against them, all of these things.
I don't think they're gonna do that. I think they're just gonna ignore
it. You don't think Chuck Todd will do
that? They'll never acknowledge it on CNN.
Okay, well that's an issue. And even more important than that we make clear what she was.
Whitewashing is an action. Versus let it go.
You could be right. I do think that there will be action. There will be an attempt to rewrite her history. And her history, just to be clear, involved, I mean, endless lies. He's been documented with, you know, more than 10,000 lies at this point. She never once admitted that he had lied or misled people in any one of those cases. But a few I do think stand out, I mean, in some of the most consequential areas. So you've listened to Donald Trump, correct? Okay, well then square that with what she said about Donald Trump and encouragement to violence against the media.
A white nationalist, he was planning a plot against Democrats, against journalists. The president has tweeted that journalists, the media, they're the enemy of the people. Is there any plans for the president to maybe tone down his rhetoric? And do you think this contributes to these sorts of extremists getting these ideas?
I certainly don't think that the president at any point has done anything but condemn violence against journalists or anyone else. In fact, every single time something like this happens, the president is typically one of the first people to condemn the violence, and the media is the first people to blame the president. We should all join together and start condemning the violence, whether it's against members of the media, whether it's against Democrats, Republicans, any person in this country. That is unacceptable, and that's why every time it comes up, we have been consistent and repeatedly said that we condemn violence in all forms.
Know exactly where she's going after she leaves this job, but I would suggest directly to hell because she lied in every way that you can lie there. I mean, you've seen him gleefully encourage violence against the media in general, but also incredibly specifically, like when Gianforte attacked a reporter for asking him a question about healthcare and he attacked him. Trump went on stage and said, "Oh, any guy that can body slam, that's my kind of guy."
Over and over again.
And then not only that, and knowing that he's done that over and over again, saying he'll pay for their medical bills and their law, their lawyers bills and all that, their legal bills. I lost my train of thought. And then both sides in the entire thing, implying that the fact that there's been multiple terror plots by people who are hardcore Trump supporters, so hardcore that they emblazon their vans with images of him, pretending that it's just a problem for everybody. It doesn't have anything to do with Donald Trump. It doesn't have anything to do with the right wing. So she is helping to cover for terrorists in the future by implying that this is not a threat that needs to be investigated.
She was a very effective press secretary.
Mm-hmm.
That's
in what way?
Because prior to her, you had Scaramucci for 15 minutes. And prior to that, you had Sean Spicer. And both of those people had the same conundrum. Same challenge, which is how do I stand before the media and lie in what is such a transparent way? And these are all journalists. These are all professional researchers who don't even need to do that research because as soon as Trump entered the public sphere as a potential candidate, they all made a little bucket of video that just kept getting fuller and fuller of the easy to access times that the president was ridiculous. And so they don't even need to use their journalism skills, they just pull from it. And all those previous press secretaries were bad at that. You could see Sean Spicer flail and be ridiculous and just lose it. And then you would see Scaramucci be too much. But the fact that Sarah Huckabee Sanders can stand there and just kind of say, no, what's blue is red and what's green is purple, and I think it's on you, and keep a straight face the entire time, that was effective. Because All she needed to do was be in keeping with the president's ridiculousness in a way that didn't seem like she was cracking a smile or acknowledging how stupid what she was saying was. And yes, she knows how stupid what she was saying was, but she didn't let on the way her predecessors had. And for that reason, she was effective. Though I do echo your sentiment, she should burn in hell.
I didn't say the burning part. I don't know exactly what happens there.
Sorry, she should sous vide in hell.
Yes. Yeah, and so individually, her willingness to do that makes me despise her on an individual level. The fact that she would do that at all, let alone for as long as she did. On an institutional level, I hate that she has revealed that Trump supporters don't care at all about whether the things that the president says are true or not. They just, it does not even enter into their thinking. It's not like it's low ranked. It does not matter at all. And she represented that. I guess she did a good job of it. It apparently is an easy job to do if you have no self-respect whatsoever. If you have no attachment to the truth whatsoever. If you'll just say, no, that's not, he was being consistent. The problems are really Democrats. I could just do that. I could do that all day long. And I hate that she helped to at least briefly derail the individual career of Michelle Wolf, at least in terms of presenting things like the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Because of her lies and the fact that a comedian pointed it out, they don't do comedy anymore at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Like, how crazy is that?
Anyway, I mean, anyone who was doing jokes that year would have suffered the same fate.
Perhaps.
And it's not Michelle Wolf's career that necessarily failed. She got a Netflix special go right after
it's
that.
More of the comedians in that context. But anyway, her lies are so bad that they actually ruin events. Anyway, she's gone. We'll see who will replace her. I'm really guessing Diamond and Silk at this point, at least for a little bit. Maybe Steven Crowder, I don't know. You don't need any comedic chops to do this job. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now to break down a case of apparently a massive failure in the criminal justice system is Aaron Morrison, senior reporter for The Appeal. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. And I want to talk about Carlton Roman. He's been in prison for nearly 30 years for a crime that he says that he did not do. And there's apparently a number of different failings along the way that resulted in him spending so much time in prison. Can you break down this case for us?
Sure. So in 1989, one of Carlton Roman's friends was killed. It was actually a double shooting. Carlton Roman's friend was killed, and then another man was killed in the basement of a home. The shooting took place in the basement of a home. And so the following day, one of the witnesses, or someone who was there when the shooting took place, fingered Roman as the trigger man. And essentially, the Queens District Attorney's Office used these two witnesses as the only evidence they had against Carlton Roman. And so, you know, the jury was convinced by their testimony. Carlton Roman went to prison. He was convicted of second degree murder and attempted murder and a slew of other charges. So he's been in prison for 30 years in upstate New York. And then years later, he discovers that there were a lot of problems with his prosecution, including the fact that there were 911 callers who were never interviewed by the prosecutor's office, and therefore they had testimony information that kind of conflicted what the police said actually happened in the shooting. So what makes it even more shocking is that Carlton Roman's attorneys believe that these 911 calls, the actual recordings of them, were never shared with his defense. So his defense team didn't even know that they had a way to poke holes in the case against him 30 years ago. And they're just finding that out now, or I would say in the last 4 years they found that out. But they've been unsuccessful in getting a court to agree to allow this information to be brought forward so that he could potentially be exonerated.
So it wasn't available at the time to his defense attorneys, but obviously it sounds like people have a pretty good idea of what both the callers and apparently the operators, what information is actually there. How much damage does it do to the original prosecutor's case? If someone like a future DA, and we're going to turn to the future of that in just a second, if they do decide to look into this, how bad does this look for the original case?
Well, for the original case, it essentially says that, like, you didn't dot all your I's and cross all your T's. And for any prosecutor's office, you don't want to, you know, they don't want to admit that they made a mistake. I think we can all sort of, the most recent example that's getting a lot of attention right now is the Central Park Five case, where, 25, 30, almost 30 years later, you've got, you know, the prosecutors who were involved in that still defending their decision to bring forward the charges against those five young boys. And so in the same way, you've got the Queens County District Attorney's Office still defending the way they prosecuted Carlton Roman.
Okay, so the longtime DA in Queens passed away, leaving us with an election that's going to happen soon. So that DA's position was that it did not need to be reviewed, that it had been done in the correct way, correct?
That is correct. The office told me that, you know, they've even reviewed Carlton Roman's case three separate times since his conviction. But each time they're not finding that they did anything wrong.
And in those reviews, do we know if they had access to that information that had not originally been present?
In the reviews, what they're essentially saying is we did the best we could with the information we had at the time. And even with the discovery of a 911 recording that was not made available to Carlton Roman's original defense attorney, what they're saying is those 911 calls don't change anything. They don't provide an avenue or mechanism for him to challenge and get his conviction vacated. But what he's hoping is that a new district attorney would come in and do a new review, give fresh eyes to his case, and also create what Queens lacks, which is a conviction integrity unit. Mm-hmm. Not almost every other borough in New York City has a conviction integrity unit, except for Queens. Those are units where when people bring forward allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, the credible allegations that come forward, there's a unit in the office, a team in the office is supposed to, review those things. And those can lead to exonerations, but often sometimes they don't.
So then it sounds like if there is going to be a new development, it's going to result from a new DA coming in. Do any of the candidates that are running in that race, have they said anything about this? Do we have any idea of what they might do if any of the individuals win?
So all seven candidates, I've spoken to all of them, reached out to all of their campaigns for the story about Carlton. All seven of them said, yes, we will create a conviction integrity unit. Now, what's interesting is that I asked all of them, are there any cases, specific cases that you would bring forward to this new unit that you would create in Queens? And none of them gave me an answer except for the candidate Mina Malik. Mina Malik actually named Carlton Roman is a case that she's interested in reviewing, giving fresh eyes. So I thought that was interesting. But I think now, given all the attention that, you know, sort of prosecutorial misconduct is getting via When They See Us, Ava DuVernay's special on Netflix, I think it's safe to say that any of the candidates running in Queens might put Carlton's case on their list for review.
Very interesting. And so from his point of view, it's obviously an important election. I'm sure he's going to be following that, and we will as well. Thank you both for your reporting on the story and joining us today, Aaron Morrison of The Appeal. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, new apparent evidence being provided by the Navy on the attack allegedly by Iran on two tankers. And Joe Biden, new video from 2006. We'll react to that after this.
I do not view abortion as a choice and a right. I think it's always a tragedy.
And that is Joe Biden. It's back in 2006, video that was just resurfaced just yesterday. We're gonna have more on that. We have to bear in mind it's 2006, but this comes up in the context of last week's little back and forth between the Biden campaign and activists who didn't like his continued support up until just last Wednesday of the Hyde Amendment that bars any sort of federal funds from supporting or going towards abortion. He did eventually back off of that within like 24 to 48 hours. Thanks to pressure, but this shows, as we will go into more of the video, that this was an issue for him that he did defer, even in his own words, from the party back in 2006, and still seems to be on somewhat shaky ground on some of these topics.
Yes, he is being bullied into a position by people who are righteous, I think. I mean, not bullied, bully's a bad word. That's why I added righteous. But like, there is the electorate around him has changed. He's 700 years old. He's been in politics for 900 years.
Great teeth, though.
His teeth are about seven.
That's awful. That's just, you're
it's
awful.
True.
It's true.
It's a thin veneer of progressivism that he's got going.
Oh my God.
So there's that.
Okay,
yeah.
This is serious.
So this is absolutely serious. This is one of the many disturbing videos that you'll see reemerge from Biden, many of which have already reemerged on this network. And just as how like the Hyde Amendment position finally made it to the mainstream media, just as the DCCC and their crazy plan to keep challengers out of the primaries finally got through to the media probably 2.5 months after it was covered here, the same is going to be happening. Yeah. So set your clock and see how long it is before that comes back up on Meet the Press.
Yes, it's gonna be around, there's gonna be more. Hopefully this one isn't a deep fake, but eventually one will be. And so we're gonna have to see how
that could
handled.
Be the solution, is the Biden campaign goes and deep fakes progressive policies from back in the day.
He might wanna look
into
that.
I think choices should be protected.
Yeah. Well, look, we got to show the actual video. So there's two different sections to this. Here is his first responding to a question about where he stands on abortion back in 2006.
I do not view abortion as a choice and a right. I think it's always a tragedy. And I think that it should be rare and safe. And I think we should be focusing on how to limit the number of abortions. And there ought to be able to have a common ground and consensus as to do that. I think the vast majority of the American people think that can be done. But unfortunately, we're put in a position you either eliminate abortions under all circumstances or it's quote abortion on demand. The fact of the matter is I've never known of a woman having an abortion and say, by the way, I feel like having an abortion. It's always a tragic decision made, always a difficult decision. And I think we should focus on how to deal with women not wanting abortions.
I don't know what that last bit means.
That's weird, because like there's that point that is true, which is like, listen, the right. It's not like people are like, hell yeah, today I get my abortion. It's either that or Disneyland. I'll flip a coin. Like, no, and abortion on demand, that is a weird Comcast service that I didn't stand up for.
But yeah, and I don't like him even using that. He's not saying that's what people are doing, I don't even like hearing it. And look, he says, even in there, he points out multiple different areas where he diverges, and we'll talk about a little bit more in terms of limitations. He would describe himself even then, let alone now, as pro-choice, but his approach to it is, I think, consistent with the sort of Democrat that, you know, they do support your continued ability to exercise your reproductive freedoms, but are they really going to fight on certain limitations like the Hyde Amendment? I mean, that in specific, no, he's not going to. But are they going to vigorously oppose state level efforts to continue to chip away women's reproductive rights? Probably not as much as someone who actually supports women's rights.
Right, this is the safe, legal, and rare era of people.
Yes.
Where rare, there's two approaches to that, to make it rare. Mm-hmm. One is to say, okay, what is going on? Is there sex education that we could do to make it more rare so you're not in that situation? Mm-hmm. And can we make it rare through some kind of other like socially progressive movement?
And he says in it that increasing economic growth and making the economy stronger tends to lead historically to lower levels of abortions. That's one way to do it. That's what he would say.
But the other way to make it rare is things like the Hyde Amendment, the Missouri effort to get to defund the local abortion clinic in the state. And then, of course, the other legal approaches in state legislatures that are already not quite representative of the entire electorate within those states because they've been gerrymandered within the inch of their life.
Yeah. Well, I want to show you one more section on terms of what limitations he, at least in 2006, was in favor of here.
I do not vote for funding for abortion. I voted against partial birth abortion. To limit it, and I vote for no restrictions on a woman's right to be able to have an abortion under Roe v. Wade. And so I am, I made everybody angry. I've made the right to life people angry because I won't support a constitutional amendment or limitations on a woman's right to exercise her constitutional right as defined by Roe v. Wade. And I've made the group, the women's groups and others very angry because I won't support public funding and I won't support partial birth abortion.
Okay, so
what a weird again, like claim.
I know,
as they say in snowboarding, after you land a trick, like everyone hates me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there, he's trying to be one of those Democrats where it's like, hey, this is bipartisanship. Everybody hates me a little bit.
No,
yeah, but they might still hate you for that same position because you just had to be convinced on the Hyde Amendment, which you were there saying you would not oppose in 2006. The whole partial birth abortion thing. That the only reason that was a topic of conversation was the right wing felt like that was a winner for them to pretend that that was anything other than what it is, which is an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly rare thing.
Yeah, and partial birth abortion.
And they're still doing a version of that now.
It's already a branding that you've accepted.
Exactly, and you're advancing.
Like death tax, marriage tax,
so,
it's a term.
Look, he's going to be asked questions about this probably at the upcoming debate, which is not far off. But this doesn't look good considering where the country has moved in the time since 2006. And I would say even where it was then. Okay, we do have to turn to other incredibly important news. Yesterday, Donald Trump, Secretary of State Pompeo, said that the two oil tankers that had been attacked, it was definitely, definitely, definitely Iran that did it, even though they provided no evidence. Well, come today, they say that they have evidence, which we're going to evaluate. Bear in mind that as of this morning, as a result of that evidence, Donald Trump went on Fox and Friends to say, Iran did do it, and you know they did do it because you saw the boat. They didn't want the evidence left behind. It was them that did it. So the boat that he's talking about will be sort of visible in this video that was released by the Navy. Let's take a look. It is difficult to see, but what they're saying that is an Iranian patrol boat removing an unexploded limpet mine from the Kokuka Courageous, one of the two damaged tankers. We also have some photos we can show you that supposedly show the location of where the damage was and where the mine was. I mean, some people are pointing out that the damage appears to be above the water line, so a mine wouldn't have done that. I don't know enough about limpet mines to evaluate that. But these photos in this video, they say are proof positive that it was Iran, even though as of today we find, oh, what were you gonna say?
Well, I just have seen that video. That's what they based, Spielberg used that to do the first scene in Saving Private Ryan. That's like what he based most of it on. Also, why, this is like.
What is this being shot on?
Satellite, I don't know.
A drone shot out of the first cell phone. okay, so, but also understand, they've got their timeline, they think that that proves it too, but the Japanese owner of that ship, one of the two oil tankers, said today that sailors on board saw, quote, flying objects just before it was hit, suggesting the vessel wasn't damaged by mines, and went on to say that that owner felt that the US was being disingenuous about the evidence that's available to them right now.
I just don't see what we seek to accomplish in this situation.
Saying that it was Iran?
Yeah.
Producing this?
I don't know what we're doing.
If you
or
want
what
a war with
doing.
Iran.
Yeah.
And they seem to be pretty hot for it.
They want some kind of regime change war in Iran to eliminate any challenge to regional superiority of the Saudis. Like, that's what they want.
And yes.
Get
you're sort of joking, but yes.
More enmeshed foothold in it. Neat. I mean, it's more like the Gulf of, oh man.
Oh God, that's a different Gulf. That seems like the most likely explanation. You could try to come up with a reason why Iran would do this, knowing that it would be used as the pretext for military action against them. That's possible. There are crazy people who make weird political moves. I mean, Donald Trump's one of them, I guess. But while we should question, we should always question the military and our government. I mean, this one in particular, I think we have even more reason to question it, considering how hot for conflict with Iran they've been. That's why Bolton is there. We know that Donald Trump has it on his mind. Right. He certainly seems to think that it's a way to get reelected. And so regardless of whatever videos or photos and deal, they'll be evaluated. Hopefully you wanna look into it, blah, 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 blah. We should be incredibly hesitant to just accept that at face value.
Yeah, especially because the person who was piloting the ship that got hit, his story conflicts, and then it just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't, at this point, no, it does not make sense. So that's the latest as of right now, we'll see what develops. We are gonna take a short break though. When we come back, new organizations set up to train future campaign managers and organizers for progressive candidates. We're gonna be talking with one of the co-founders of that movement after this. To move this country in the right direction, we're going to need the right progressive candidates, and they're going to need the right staff. But especially thanks to recent moves by the DCCC, it's going to be hard for them to get that from traditional outlets. And so they need the right sort of trained progressive staff. And we're joined now by Alona Duverge, co-founder of the Movement School, to talk about how they might develop that. Alona, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, I'm very glad to have you here as well. I just read about the Movement School and The Intercept yesterday, and now we get an opportunity to talk to you about it. So for people who might not have read that article or aren't familiar with it, what is the Movement School?
Right. So Movement School is a program that my co-founder and I, Gabe Tobias, co-founded together. And it's a 10-week program. We built a campaign simulation where the fellows get put into teams in different campaigns, get given different scenarios with their own data, their own mock candidate. And the assignments that are given to them are really made to recreate the process that you might go on the campaign. So post-graduation, these fellows are truly prepared to jump on any campaign that they may want to work on afterwards.
And there's a connection to a past campaign, the campaign of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, correct?
Yes, correct. So my co-founder and I, we developed Movement School while on working on the Ocasio-Cortez campaign. It was something so special that happened on that campaign because we really saw the power of organizing. And we didn't have the resources that other candidates may have had in the past. So we really had to train our own volunteers, you know, people from the community on how to do this job so we can win. So we developed a series of webinars that trained volunteers on how to create, you know, their own universes, how to do voter targeting, how to talk to voters, the whole nine yards. And that's what happens when you train people from the community that are actually from there, because they're so much more invested in this process. And they are the ones that truly deserve this training, because a problem that we try to solve with Movement School is that we want to make campaigns more representative of their communities. And oftentimes that doesn't happen. You see a lot of surrogates coming in from all over the country to run campaigns in communities they know nothing about. So in terms of really giving power back to the community and building from the bottom up, we saw that the importance of training community members on how to do this job.
And you've already had one cohort go through the training, right?
Yes, correct. So we just had our first cohort of 40 fellows just graduated about 2 weeks ago, actually the same time that I was graduating from college. So it was a really exciting time. And I'm really, really proud of the cohort. And they're going off to do amazing things. They're working on presidential campaigns, state-led campaigns, starting their own initiatives. Our first cohort was comprised of 82% people of color, 70% women and gender non-binary people, 20% people with disabilities, and 80% people from working class backgrounds. So those are the people that deserve to have these positions. And those are the people that need these resources so they can learn how to organize in their communities and really, really fight for that community power, because we see that when you give power back to community, you get people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected. And here in New York, I was the field director, the regional field director for the Alessandra Biaggi campaign, who she went against Jeff Klein in the New York State Senate. And again, we implemented that strategy, and again, she won because we put community first and we really gave power back to them.
And I have heard that there is a fast approaching deadline to apply to be in one of the next cohorts at the Movement School, right?
Yes. So our deadline is June 15th. So tomorrow at midnight, I encourage everyone to apply, especially if you want to get involved and maybe haven't found your place, maybe are looking around. Like oftentimes, myself, I ran into this a lot where I would oftentimes look around and I wouldn't see a lot of people that looked like me in this space. So if you feel like you're one of those people, if you feel like your voice isn't really heard, and we have a home for you here at Movement School, and we want to be able to train you so you can be the leader that you're meant to be.
You know, I'm curious too, down the line, is the expectation or maybe just a hope that some of the people you're going to be training to be organizers, campaign managers, and things like that might be candidates themselves eventually?
I mean, the sky's the limit for these fellows. That's the perfect, this is why I love them so much. And anyone that goes through the program, we really create this tight-knit network. And I believe that the best candidates that launch themselves are activists, are community organizers, because they are the ones that truly understand that the power comes from the bottom up. And it's not just some career politician, or it's not just some career attorney or lawyer, but people that are actually from the community, have been organizing the community, and know the struggles of their neighbors. Those are the people that we want representing us. So I would love if any of my fellows were to actually become candidates one day.
Well, this sounds awesome. As an organization to go along with groups like Justice Democrats and others that are trying to get the candidates there, they need support. This sounds like a great way for them to get it. As you said, the deadline is tomorrow at midnight. I will try to get my application in time. Please be nice to be in that process. But Ilona, thank you so much for joining us. You're doing great work.
Thank you so much again.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, it's time for Good Chart, Bad Chart to end the week with. Okay, this is Good Chart, Bad Chart. We're gonna close out the week with a little bit of good news, which means starting off with the bad chart. I saw this tweeted out by Matt Brunig. Over the last 30 years, the top 1% has added $21 trillion to their wealth, while the bottom 50% has lost $900 billion. I think we should clap for capitalism in America. No,
I'd rather have the clap.
It's complex.
And see that fact bear out in real life.
That's absurd. Like,
things that were bearing out got me the clap.
Like, we could, I know that there's no way that you could change from one world to this hypothetical world that I'm gonna sketch out, but like, you could do the entire cost to remake the American like energy production sector to account for climate change, and the rich still would be as rich as they were 30 years ago if you did not transfer that wealth. I know it's a ridiculous
comparison.
I feel
like the rich should have, sorry, it's what?
I think that looking at that, I think it was Anon on Twitter was like, every presidential candidate should have to say, what do you make of this? And what would you do or would you not do to address that sort of trend going forward?
Right. I think that the super rich should have some kind of number where they admit that is really bad for them to have more money than that. Just from a stability.
Do you think we've reached that?
This looks like a trend over time. And if the trend continues, the bottom will have nothing.
Yes.
More nothing than they have. Mm-hmm. And it will become a untenable situation, as it has over and over throughout history. Mm-hmm. They need to do something about it.
Yeah.
There needs to be at least some kind of pressure release valve.
The thing that bothers me is that I spend time on Twitter, I shouldn't. And so I see the people who, anytime I post anything about socialism, whatever, they're always like, that's how you die. You need free economic freedom through capitalism. But like, that's capitalism working. That's not like, oh no, the gears have run off the capitalism machine. It's like when you get capitalism and you allow it to spend unlimited amounts on politics, this is the result. But like, we keep cutting taxes literally over those 30 years, that wealth is going to be transferred. That's what each individual tax cut is intended to achieve. And over the course of 30 years, that's what you get.
Let's do the next good chart, and then I'll say why these are both bad charts.
They're both bad charts. Okay, well, in that case, we're gonna move to the good chart, at least from my point of view. We don't have to agree necessarily. So this one's going back just a little bit, but it is polling from in February on what younger generations think about capitalism and socialism. Are they scared of socialism? Well, on individual policies, if you bring this up, you're gonna see that compared to the rest of the population, they're a little bit more likely to think that the government should provide universal healthcare, significantly more likely to think the government should provide tuition-free college, a big junk on preferring to live in a socialist country, which is sort of giving away the game there. Supporting abolishing ICE really doesn't have anything to do with socialism or whatever, but things like high earnings result of free enterprise, they are not as likely to believe that. It's pretty close, but they are questioning some of the economic orthodoxy that our system has lived on.
It seems like the youth of America are the only ones fully capable of understanding an argument about socialism versus capitalism divorced from Cold War legacy hatred.
Okay.
And that's it. It's everyone that I see over and over again, even if it is, including Bernie and CNN, it's just this idea of using, not actually including Bernie, but when you say socialism, it automatically departs from any philosophical conversation into a legacy Cold War socialism versus capitalism argument. That is less based on those economic and political systems and more based on whose side were we on back then? And that's frustrating to call.
And you're saying the young people are not as wrapped up in that.
They're not wrapped up. They're just like, I read about socialism and I'm applying that definition to the countries that have what that definition seems to be, like in Europe, and they seem to pay less for healthcare and get better results. And I'm just saying, like, that's my definition of socialism, how it bears out. But then you have the right that uses the word socialism as a cudgel to say it's responsible for millions and jillions of death. And my response to that is no. The same, it's corruption that's responsible for the millions and millions of death from dictators who used the banner of socialism to become fascist dictators.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. And that's why I say it's the corruption in capitalism. It's the corruption in a system that we have now, which is largely capitalistic, that allows people who, once they get over a certain level of wealth, to use their monetary influence to corrupt a system. The same way in these socialist countries throughout the ages that they say are so corrupt, then the party apparatus has gotten so much power that the people within it at the top have used that system's leeway to facilitate corruption to corrupt the system and turn it into a brutal, like, state media. And again, that feels super fascist, propagandic dictatorship.
Yeah, we don't have a ton of time to break down, like, different theories of political economy
we'll just
and things
go
like
over
that.
Today.
But people act as if the money itself is an independent variable for political calculations, when, as you point out, it is not. It is not just a force multiplier for making more money independent of politics. It allows you to use politics to make more money. The bigger problem overall, and I would agree, and I think this is an issue for a country, is that when people use the term socialism or capitalism or communism or fascism, any term basically, almost nobody knows at all what they're talking about. And that seems like a big problem. They talk about socialism, they talk about capitalism, not understanding that our economy is already a melding of different concepts in various points and over time. And so I feel like we should start to have deep dives into what words mean, I think. Because Donald Trump called Nancy Pelosi a fascist for saying that he's engaged in a cover-up. I don't even know what connection that has to the particular political economic construct that is fascism historically.
But
people use these terms because they feel like they can win arguments just by throwing the term out.
But like Bernie called Trump a corporate socialist in a speech meant to make socialism sound more palatable.
Well, I think what he is trying to say is that there are different versions of socialism. I think he's sort of saying what I'm saying. We already have socialism in some forms. One form of it is the particular type of corporate socialism that people like Donald Trump like.
And again,
and a lot of Democrats.
Well, not again, for the first time. I haven't listened to all of Bernie's speech, but I will say that I think the winning strategy is to say, I don't care what you call anything. I hate corruption.
Okay.
And I think that every time we can have some kind of means by which to check corrupting powers, we should do that, period.
Yes, I think the system desperately needs a correction. I would go beyond just checking the corruption, but I think that's long overdue. And the nepotism, by the way, at least in the administration we've got right now. Brett, as always, thank you so much.
It is great. Happy half hour today.
Happy half hour. Should be fun. It's an old-fashioned episode. a little bit. Oh, you can drink those on that show. Anyway, thank you everybody for watching us both today and throughout the week. It's been great. We'll see you next week with probably more chaos. We'll see.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.